Welcome back to A World of Fragile Truths, Season 3. It's been half a year since we spoke and the latest evidence has been piling up on your desk, so about time for another episode where we unpack the latest evidence for security and rule of law, which show the assumptions under our sector's work are often fragile. My name is Christian Kuitert from the knowledge platform Security and Rule of Law, and today's latest evidence comes from our guest Sukanya Potter, a researcher from King's College London. She recently wrote a book called Peacebuilding Legacy, in which she proposes a form of peacebuilding which results should actually pass the test of time and scale, with a prominent role for youth leadership. Because Sierra Leone is a prominent case study in the book, we also have invited Isata Mahoy, who will link this book to her experiences as, amongst others, National Network Coordinator for the West Africa Network for Peacebuilding. As you'll notice, she has a wide range of expertise from gender, specifically women customary land rights, to economic policy, to conflict resolution, and even acting performances in community radio. Thank you both for being here, Isata and Sukanya.
Thank you so much, Christian.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, as I said, we have a radio actor even here with you, Isata. And Sukanya, I heard that you also already were in podcast before, so we have a veteran lineup here to kick off the new season. Let's simply start with the title of your book, maybe, Sukanya, the Legacy for Peacebuilding. What do you mean by that exactly?
Christian, by legacy, I mean thinking about the long-term effects of peacebuilding programs. What happens after these organizations fold up and they leave and they move to another context?
And how is that new? I mean, doesn't everybody envision what they leave behind after the project and what their exit strategy should be?
Interestingly, Christian, very few donors and peacebuilding organizations have invested in the study of legacy. There's a tendency within peacebuilding to be very short-term, to be time-bound, you know, linked to various projects which are 9 to 12 months long. So often there is neither the time nor the resources.
All right. Well, let's dive into how we can overcome this maybe then, and also the root causes for this. But Isata, maybe first to you then, do you recognize this lack of legacy thinking? Is it something that is discussed in your, for example, in your network of peace builders in Sierra Leone as well?
The peace building legacy in Sierra Leone is something that we are still struggling to achieve. We know that for a country transiting from war, it has a lot of things that has to be put in place. For instance, you have to look at transitional justice issues, issues of peace building, good governance. So building that legacy by organizations that were even before the war in existence, it's a whole process in itself. I'll give you some examples from the Sierra Leonean perspective. We had what we call the Bintoumani 1, Bintoumani 2. And recently, in 2019, 2020, we had what we call the Bintoumani 3 as well. All of these Bintoumanis are conferences that were organized by civil society organizations in terms of bringing actors together, stakeholders together, mm-hmm. so that they'll be able to talk and map the way forward for peace. So these are legacies that we have in Sierra Leone today. And also since that time, it has made the civil society more formidable in terms of trying to promote development generally.
Christian, this is a good example in the context of what happens after international presence diminishes, right? So how national actors initially envisage, you know, their own role in peace building. But in terms of my own project, and you know, this has been a decade-long effort, I actually am engaging with three important dimensions, and we can discuss this further. The first is, you know, the norms and the values and the ideas that are being transmitted through various peace building projects. Mm-hmm. And Isata, for example, has been involved with the soap opera, a long-running soap opera on community radio in Sierra Leone called Atunda Ayanda. Now, radio, as you might know, prior to the advent of social media, has been one of the most important ways through which to communicate ideas and also to provide valuable information to rural populations. And in the Sierra Leone case, what is really important to understand is that both during the war and after the war ended, both the United Nations mission and various non-governmental organizations, they started bespoke programs as a form of outreach to share ideas, to encourage discussion. And these normative legacies in terms of the long-term effects of these ideas is one of the elements that I'm examining in the book. And maybe we can ask Isata more about this.
So Isata, you worked with community radio on such norms. Can you tell us some more about that? And do you feel like these norms were indeed set at the right level, at the right ambition? What did this evoke?
Okay. Community radio stations were one of the institutions or the structures that Search for Common Ground worked with during their days in Sierra Leone. They needed to also ensure that people also participate in the process itself of promoting peace in the country. So they decided that they support communities in terms of establishing community radio stations. So they did like stakeholder analyses and then also map local authorities and see and talk to them the need about the need for having radio stations. At that time, if I could remember vividly, there were only few radio stations in Sierra Leone at that time. And today, we'll be proud to say we have several community radio stations, you know, following from the footprint of what Search did. You know, that was an exit strategy. So it is right for Sukanya to say it's a legacy for peace building in Sierra Leone. You know, when we were like producing the radio station, the radio discussions, maybe like it has to do with women issues, children's issues, or bringing parliament to the people, the Atundayanda itself that talk on key or complex issues in the country, people listen. People are always
glued. What did such an episode look like if you would talk about such topics?
Okay, like for instance, you have Atunda Ayenda. Atunda Ayenda was bringing on daily happenings in Sierra Leone, but in the comic, using comic relief as well, and also tweaking the names of key actors, the names of towns, so that people see themselves. And exactly this is happening. So when it is like, if it is 5 o'clock that the program is to be aired, everybody will leave their work and then they will stay glued to radio stations. So if it is the radio belongs to maybe to the teacher, you will see everybody come around the teacher's house just to listen to that episode. We did not just make up the stories. These are histories that, this was history that was dug out from community people themselves. So some of the character, the people on the field saw themselves as, I am Rambo. Oh, I am Tapia. The other character, I am Demba. So, you know, it was really come again?
So this was a very popular satire, and I think it's amazing joining together around the radio and automatically starting discussions about these kind of topics together. So it's a very interesting approach. And Sukanya, so this is then talking about norms and about behavior together. It is also, of course, funded by international actors. So I was wondering, is there sometimes, can there be tension as well there? Because, yeah, international actors maybe have different types of ideals and different types of norms than communities that are listening to these radio stations, et cetera, et cetera. So
obviously the idea, you know, the ideas, the norms that were being transferred through radio, for example, through programs like Atunda Ayanda, there was great uptake in certain areas, particularly in areas like women's participation, democratic participation, you know, enforcing governance norms or accountability. And in some ways, there was a shift from right after the war when there was a very nebulous space for programs. They were very authentic. But with time or over time, and this is an important element to note, the space for peace-building programs becomes much more structured and reflecting the priorities of donors. So if donors want to focus on issues like rule of law, security sector reform, these may or may not be the priorities for communities at that time. The priorities might be different. You know, it could be about conflict resolution or transitional justice. These are also dealt with, but there's a tendency to structure or funnel programming funds around themes. And this tends to mimic or reflect an international prioritization of focus.
How would you then switch that around, you'd say?
Sierra Leone, actually, during the war, several local civil society organizations were very effective in using what we call traditional mechanisms for conflict resolution. Because peace-building funds are funneled through these 9-12-month-long projects and focus on certain themes, even if there is positive effects coming from these projects. For example, let's take the area of children's rights. But what happened is children's rights as a theme or as an idea lost currency with donors. Often the funds from donors could not be secured to continue. Donors wanted to focus on other things like countering violent extremism. There needs to be sustained programming in certain areas over many, many years.
Don't go with the latest whims in the donor community, but really what is important at the level where you're working. Thank you for these experiences already, and we'll take a quick break to hear what other members of our network think of this topic. And after that, we'll discuss, for example, the role of youth in this peace building legacy.
My name is Ameya Kilara from Intermediate in London. When I think of the legacy of peacebuilding efforts in Kashmir, I think of people, ideas, and relationships that outlast the highs and lows of a long-standing political conflict. I think of Waleed, a former militant from the apple town of Shopian in Kashmir, heartbroken that he couldn't return home. And even after sacrificing so much, he wanted peace, but always reminded us that he wants peace with dignity. I think of the idea that if you can't change a border, why not make borders irrelevant? In Kashmir, it led to opening up the line of control, akin to the Berlin Wall, for divided families to reunite after decades of separation. I think of two former enemy spy chiefs from India and Pakistan who wrote a book together about a shared vision for peace. Examples of extraordinary collaboration when people manage to transcend their identities. More than anything, a sense of possibility and hope that conflicts can be resolved through dialogue and negotiations, for me, is the legacy of long-term peace building. And that needs to be preserved and cherished, notwithstanding the political currents of the day.
Thank you for contributing. Now, let's talk about the role of youth. I found it very interesting that in the book, it was described how different generations, especially now that conflicts are, they take a longer time, different generations have different experiences of the conflict and attitudes towards peace and peace building. And you, of course, Sukanya, also emphasize that the role of youth is crucial for leaving a legacy for peace building. So I was wondering, Isata, how did you include the role of youth and maybe the intergenerational aspects of how people have different attitudes towards each other, towards norms, towards behavior?
Okay. Youth or young people themselves played some key role during the war, some of them being perpetrators, others being victims. They were also included in the productions of some of our radio programs then at Search for Common Ground Studios. You know, we had programs like Golden Kids News. This program brought together kids from diverse backgrounds. We had ex-child combatants. We had children that were raped. We had children that suffered. So all of these children were brought together in terms of trying to reform their minds. We had what we call straight talk. Straight talk was looking at sexual reproductive health and HIV-related issues. And there was another one on quality education, which was Olu. Olu was a group of children that they were training to be producers and journalists at that time.
So we'll go to radio stations, train them on particular topics. If they are looking at FGM, which is the female genital mutilation discussion, we'll discuss this, and then they will act and play at the end of the day. So it's like a 5 or 10 minute drama, followed by a panel discussion that was discussed by different young people. So this was in a bid to also include children in the development process. But looking at the including a young people population in Sierra Leone today, which is about 70 to 75%, but these young people are being used, you know, they are being brainwashed in terms of committing crimes, like creating conflict or violence at community level. So today we are still faced with that particular challenge. We need to continuously engage them in terms of trying for them to understand their potentials in the country, and also for them to deviate from the narrative which their lives have been set to be, and to a better future for themselves.
In this case,
the young people were also not left behind during that time.
Yeah. Christian, if I were to add here, I think in the Sierra Leone case, although children and youth issues and women's issues received a great deal of attention, if you systematically try and map, and I did it only with one organization, but if you systematically try and map the amount of money the donors funded, you will see that often this funding was quite ad hoc. The themes kept moving, you know, the priorities kept changing, which meant that there was no sustained effort in any particular area, like I mentioned, which are children's rights. Often certain areas that were of great value to communities, you know, because there was not enough donor funding, they had to discontinue projects. So in the sense of institutional legacy, you know, community radio, as I mentioned, although they struggle financially, they're still an example of accidental legacies. In other cases, the bike riders unions, in terms of the bigger picture of youth and peace building, I think Sierra Leone is now entering a period of youth bulge. The population is youthful, you know, under 25, a large portion of the population. And this generation has very different experiences of peace and memories of conflict from their older generation, from their parents, from their families, from their elders. Older people have certain memories of conflict, losses that they suffered, and also expectations out of peace. Versus the children who were born after the war, you know, their realities are shaped by this post-conflict society where economic struggles exist, where, you know, education is a struggle as well, where services are missing, where there's a huge international presence. And in this sort of a mix, the expectations from the state and how the state-citizen relationship is shaped with the youthful population. What do they expect from the state? How, you know, what is their demands in terms of accountability or governance? And this is all shaped in the context of these donor-funded programs, which are almost preaching what young people should expect.
So is there maybe to get towards recommendations and conclusions, because we're running out of time, what would be your main recommendation then?
I think two points. The first is most organizations need to think about their own organizational legacy, which is what is their overall strategy and what are they going to leave behind? What is their handover or succession plan? Few organizations engage in the learning and reflection that is necessary to adjust their projects and to make these resonate with local norms, local values, local requirements, and to focus programming in certain areas and to specialize in certain areas and do multiple years worth of programming so that there's actual transformation and transfer of learning to local organizations in terms of succession and exit strategies.
And what does this mean, Isata, do you think, for your network of peace builders? Does it mean that people will have to connect with different partners, or do they, what does this mean for this network that you are coordinating?
In terms of trying to sustain or trying to ensure that the legacies of peace building does not derail from where we want it to be, I think it has to be a lot of coordinated efforts in terms of promoting peace building.
Because I think when the war was there, or when it was coming to an end, a lot of donor agencies were coming to, I mean, funding a particular activity, maybe two or three institutions without checking the impact of what the funds are being used for. I think it's a moment where we should think about not duplicating funds at this time, and also trying to ensure that those funds reach the right people and at the right time. We failed at that particular point. And trying to ensure that the young people is we present strategies that will help them overcome those the trauma that happened to them some years ago. Because I'll rightly tell you that a lot of them that are the Okada riders, the tricycle riders, are those that were involved during the war. Until today, some of those actions that they were committing, like being arrogant, is still in existence. So we should be looking at how to also address issues like that.
Hmm. So invest in good exit strategies, I hear, but also sustained efforts that really fit the issues that really are present at the level that you're working with, and not just buzzwords internationally. Better coordination between the different actors, and really include youth in their often very difficult experiences. So Kanya, I saw you wanted to have one last point before we round up.
Just in terms of final takeaway. The final point is in terms of young people. I think Sierra Leone is a great case where youth can't teach peace. They need to be able to sustain themselves economically in terms of their education, in terms of their wider personal growth and development. And often these projects tend to be such short-term, transient efforts that they often don't add up to a more transformative effect. But if we do peace building in a sustained kind of way, with a focus, with coordinated efforts, with certain organizations focusing on similar themes for multiple years, we can actually bring about transformation through what I call technocratic peace building, and there can be stronger legacies and stronger conflict transformation.
Well, who would have known that technocratic peace building would have been a positive word in this sense? Yeah, there we have it, a good combination of ideas to make sure that this legacy of peace building is ensured. We're at the end of our episode, so thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed this conversation, and you really raised the bar for this new season and gave a difficult task to make us keep up with this level. So, and thanks for that. Also, of course, on behalf of our listeners, great that you found us again, and keep on demystifying those fragile truths in your work. See you next time.